Hey guys, don't forget the 2023 Street Cop Training Conference, Nashville, Tennessee, April 23rd through the 28th. You do not want to miss this. So far, guest speakers, Rob O'Neill, the Navy SEAL that was responsible for killing Osama bin Laden, Kyle Carpenter, U.S. Marine, Medal of Honor recipient, jumping on an IED to protect his platoon. Fox News host Tommy Lahren returns for 2023. Sheriff Wayne Ivey, Sheriff Mark Lamb, Sheriff David Clark, and more to come. You don't want to miss this event. We additionally have 20 of the country's top law enforcement educators giving you the best experience of your life. You will leave this event knowing more about your job and how to be proficient at the things you do, hands down, any other event that you'll ever attend. I personally guarantee it. Don't miss out. There's a room code at streetcop.com for our room block and room code at the Gaylord at Opry is where the event's taking place. Don't miss out on a discounted rate. The rate is from Sunday to Thursday. Put that in and find yourselves at a half-price room. Split it with a friend, but make sure you get there. You don't want to miss this event. It is going to be that good. If you trust me and you trust Street Cop, trust that you will leave there feeling like you've had an experience of a lifetime.
You trying to be a street cop?
Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. Your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and I have with me today one of the crazy story of surviving a significant critical incident. And I'm sure we're going to find a lot of value in this, as I believe that you're speaking now around the country to all sorts of groups of law enforcement officers. You can let me know all about that, and I'll let you guys, or I'll let you introduce yourself. This is Officer Ann Carrizales. Oh, can I make it a little more Spanish? Can I do a little more Spanish?
Can you roll it? Are you going to roll it?
Yeah, I'm going to try. I got you. Oficial Ann Carrizales.
It's Carrizales.
Carrizales.
Carrizales, yes.
So, lady, who are you? Tell us who you are. Tell us about what you did in life, and then, you know, we'll go into other things.
I am me. I'm Anne Marie. I am the daughter of a U.S. Marine Corps veteran, actual dual service, Army and Marine Corps, Vietnam veteran, now retired minister. And I have three other siblings, so there's four of us, two boys and two girls. But I joined the Marine Corps right out of high school. And as a Marine, I was a military police officer. So that's kind of where everything started for me. I started as a cop as a military cop first, military police. And then I transitioned into my civilian police career much later in life, after I was done with my Marine career and my fight background. Cause I also in between there, I had a fight career, a boxing career. And so I'm a former fight champion as well. I got two babies. My boy is my monkey. He is 27. And my daughter is 18. She's my little dove. So I mean, there's really not anything really super significant about me outside of that. I was a Marine, and I was raised by a Marine, Army dog, and I'm a cop. And it's kind of always just been, I think, who I am outside of even before I was doing it. You remember safety patrols in school? You do, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
They used to wear those little orange things.
I was one of them.
I was too. Did you take that shit mad serious? Because I did.
No. See, like, I was like the mafia cop of the fucking safety patrol. Like, I would sneak people out of school. I was I wanted to get out of like school. And actually, at that time, that was the gig.
Early.
That was the gig. Mm-hmm. Like, you had to get out. Like, you had to be somebody to be on the set. I didn't take it too seriously, but I just wanted to be out of school. I hated school.
Well, I think our safety patrols were better because we
excuse me, young lady,
the halls two to three deep.
Let me just interrupt you for a second. Are
we gone? I
watched you roll your eyes. And you know, I have nothing bad to say about Texas, because I actually like that state. Now, what part of Texas are you from?
So now, I was not born in Texas, but I was raised in Texas the majority of my life because of my family roots. I was born when my dad was in the Marine Corps. So I was born over there in California, in Orange County, in San Clemente. But I was raised in Corpus Christi. So in between the two states of California and Texas has been, you know, my life. But no, I mean, I'm just a normal person. I mean, just a normal person. I came from a loving family. We had our problems like a lot of people. You know, dad being a returning Vietnam veteran struggled like a lot of those veterans did. So I had a tough upbringing coming up. But I think that those were really beautiful lessons for me. They created a very resilient version of myself, preparing me for the struggles I was going to have in life. Obviously, one that I had when I turned 40 years old, where I was almost killed. So I think that it was a tough life, but it served me later in life in a way that I could have never thought it would at that time anyway.
When did you start your law enforcement career? How old were you? 38, 37?
18.
No, I'm saying the civilian one.
36.
So you had your 20-year retirement at the military, then took a job with Corpus Christi Police?
Well, I didn't retire out of the Marine Corps. I got out of the Marine Corps after I was honorably discharged, and I went to pursue my fight career. I started boxing in the Marine Corps. I was the first woman in history to box for the Marine Corps.
No shit. And,
yeah.
Congrats. It's awesome.
Thank you. I was the first woman in history to represent the Marine Corps in the sport of boxing. And I went on to become ranked number one in the country, number two in the world. So I won a U.S. Thanks. Many moons and many pounds ago. But yeah, nobody can take that from me. That's for sure. I did that shit. That's me. I did that.
Mm-hmm. That's really, really cool.
I thought so. It was fun. I didn't even realize at the time what a big deal it was. Seriously, that's the kind of stuff you realize later. Like, I got inducted into the All Marine Boxing Hall of Fame.
I feel like I'm in the presence of greatness right now.
What? Did you not hear me? Did you not hear my name? It's Carrizales. Do you know what that translates to in English?
Probably best boxer in the Marine Corps.
No. I appreciate it, though. No, I appreciate it. I have really been blessed, though. I've done some pretty cool things, I will admit. It's been fun. But, you know, you got to go for those types of things. I think a lot of times people think about things they want to do, but they don't go for it. It's because it scares them or for whatever reason. You know, people have their reasons. I just kind of went for stuff. I've always kind of been like that.
Now, let's go into some of these incidences, and then we'll go into what you're doing post that. But tell me about your law enforcement civilian career, and maybe we'll just lead into some of these significant instances in your life that basically brought us together today.
Interestingly enough, I don't have any. I've held lots of different hats in my law enforcement career. In my combined almost, you know, I have about 19 years combined military police and civilian police service. I've held just about every billet you could possibly hold. But I don't have, in my civilian career, I don't carry any rank. So I work patrol. Now, as a matter of fact, I am working as a reserve officer for the agency that I work for because I teach full time. I have a public speaking company and I present, you know, the Fight After the Fight series. Plus I teach. I'm a national police instructor as well. So I'm really busy wearing a lot of hats and I am not out there on the streets as much as I used to be when I was there full time. But I don't have any rank at the police department. But one of my favorite billets is field training. I love training new officers. Okay. So if we're talking about a professional resume, I think the easiest way to say it would be that I've pretty much done just about anything you can do in law enforcement to include investigations. But my favorite part is training rookies, training new officers as they're coming in, taking all of the experiences, you know, that I have and kind of just paying that forward. You know, remember, especially for women, it's very different because aside from everything that you got to learn about the job and the stuff that you're taught, because you have to keep in mind, a lot of us you're taught from a perspective of a man, right? Because this is just the way it is. But there are also different considerations that women have to make that, you know, what are you going to tell me about, you know, trying to find the best, most effective ways to nurse and pump when you're coming back off maternity leave, right? You're not going to teach me that. You're not going to talk to me about watch out with these types of sports bras and this material because they'll rub your skin right off or, you know, like just the little tips like that. So I like, you know, especially when I have women rookies being able to pass down just those little, it's the little things, it's the little things that I wished, you know, somebody would have told me. So I really like doing that for our, you know, new women coming into the career. Giving them things to think about, telling them things I wish somebody would have told me, you know, 5 minutes into my career, teaching male officers the same way, giving them that female perspective. Because, I mean, let's face it, women police differently than men, right? We do. And there's a reason why we police differently. So I think I like to take that stuff and that knowledge and pass that knowledge on to, you know, the men and the women just to kind of give back from everything I've picked up along the way. So I've held just about every billet you can, and I've done, you know, the things that I've wanted to do. I like to run and gun. I love to police at night. But for now, I'm finding real purpose in the journey that I'm on of teaching cops in a different way. So different than I did as an FTO. And I wouldn't be here doing that now had it not been for, you know, the night of October 26, 2013, when I made that traffic stop that was literally almost the last traffic stop of my life.
We are cut from the same cloth. This is exactly what I do for a living.
Yeah.
And it's a very similar story. In some ways different, but in some ways very similar.
How's that?
Field training, I thought was important. I always thought that I could train and make things better. And now we make better things to make things better. And
yep.
I don't know the exact number of cops we'll teach this year as a training company, but I'm sure it's in excess of 30,000 cops this year. Mm-hmm. And to be able to deliver the content that we do on the platforms that we have, it's not about me. It's about essentially what people are getting out of it. And I mean, literally, I probably have 10, 15 messages right now because I haven't checked my message on Instagram of how important the work that we're doing is for these people right. And how much we're changing things.
Right. No, you're right. We're in the same. So you're right. Like I'm basically, you know, you with a uterus and maybe not so great skin. You know, I've heard a lot of really great things about the street cop training. I really have.
Thank you.
The podcast itself and the social media presence. To be quite honest, I had seen some things, but I wasn't super familiar with it. And I started to dig around and poke around and be nosy and just chat. And it's really good stuff. Really good stuff. Thank you. I appreciate y'all having me on. Thank you.
No, we were honored to have you. We're blessed that you're here. So
yes, for sure.
Let's jump into October 20th, 2013. Tell me about it.
So, October 26th of 2013 was almost a year.
It was the 26th?
Later. Correct.
My bad. Sorry.
That's okay. No problem. October 26th was almost a year to the day later after my first shooting, which was October 14th of 2012.
What happened there? Let's start with that one.
Okay. Yeah. I wasn't sure how familiar we were with that. And, you know, it's not anything as dramatic as the second one, but it is nonetheless a critical incident. You know, most people go through their career and they don't ever find themselves involved in an OIS, right? An officer involved shooting is just one of those things that pretty much all of us hope to never have to ever go through, but sometimes you do. And then for those very select few of us, you go through it more than once. And I was one of those people. Lightning struck twice for me. And so on October the 14th, I came face to face with a suspect who, without getting all into that, because that's kind of like going to take away from the time of this other one. But I found myself with my arm pinned in this car window of this suspect who decides to hit the gas and take me for a little ride. So he drags me down the road and ultimately slams on the brakes and the glass shatters, right? Because the weight of my petite frame was lodged in this window. And so I go flying from this window that's shattered. And unfortunately for him, I ended up hitting the ground and I rolled and popped back up. And when I popped back up, what I recall is trying to get my footing, gain my footing, because I'm still hat with the momentum of the car and all that. I'm still kind of moving faster than my feet can kind of keep up. So I'm trying to get my footing back and I find myself in front of these headlights. And these headlights, and I have the light is shining into my eyes. And I remember I was having trouble seeing because I felt like I had like flecks of little specks of glass in my eyes, and I had glass in my arm and in my scalp. And so I was trying to make sense of it all, you know, kind of get my bearings about me. And eventually what ended up happening is it sounds like a whole long thing, but it's literally a split second where I find myself in front of headlights. I draw my firearm and I put one down range and it goes into the windshield and strikes him in the face. So when that happens, as you know, simultaneously, you know, I'm shooting and then I'm moving and I'm taking flank position. I'm trying to move on over to my right and kind of get out of the way of this car that I believe was coming at me. And I realize that because there's no more window there, once I get off just to kind of like a 45 degree angle of his position, that he's been hit in the face and his face has dropped down and his hands come up. And so we were pretty much done at this point. There was there was no reason anymore for me to keep shooting. I did not. The one shot gave me the position that I needed, gave me the opportunity that I needed to kind of get myself out of harm's way and kind of stop the threat there. And he survived that. I survived that. I had minor injuries. He had serious injuries to his face, but he survived. I think I had a small linear tear in my rotator cuff, massive bruising under my arm. And I had to get this little cut here on my arm, kind of like stitched, very minor stuff, but I went home, I made it home, you know, and you ask any cop anywhere across the country and that's our goal, right? To make it home. And so I made it home, but I did feel like at that point, there was a lot of things that I needed to change about how I responded in a situation like that, particularly because I felt like I knew that I would be in a situation like that again. I don't know if you've ever been, you yourself, Dennis, ever been in a critical incident like that, but if you have undoubtedly met a lot of people across the country who have, and one thing they will always tell you, and you could ask this question if you aren't already, but they will always tell you this. I felt, I had this conviction in my gut. I knew it would happen again. I knew it. We go out on the job and we know it's always a possibility, but not anymore. I mean, ever since that happened, it's not like I go to work knowing that it's a possibility. It is a very real, it will happen and I am going to be ready. And so that's kind of what I was left with in the aftermath of that first shooting. It was a real good lesson for me, because up until that point, I would have jumped up screaming that I was ready. If you came at me and said, "Hey, are you ready? Are you ready for something like that?" I'd have been like, "I was born ready. I'm ready. I'm ready." And I think that was kind of a very big eye opener for me, that first shooting, in that I was not as ready as I really thought I was. And I think that's the case for a lot of cops across the country. A lot of us think we're ready for some shit like that. And till it happens, and then you find yourself not as prepared as you would have liked to have been. So for that year in between the two, from October 2012 to October 2013, I just readied and readied and readied myself. I read articles, I watched and studied videos. It was almost obsessive. You know, I remember my ex-husband saying to me at the time, "You know, that can't be healthy. You're always, this is too much. Like, this can't be healthy for you." He's not in law enforcement, right? So he thought it was too much, but I remember feeling this is exactly what I need to do, because I'm not going to allow myself to come so close to being taken out on those streets, because I was not prepared. And then I get shot twice and I'm like, well, here we are again. But yeah, that was kind of the lead up and the build up into October 2013's incident, which happened on the 26th. So like I said, almost a year to the date, October 14, 2012, October 26, 2013, when I found myself, you know, staring down the barrel of a gun and getting shot twice.
Before we go there, how far away do you think you were when you took that shot at that truck or that vehicle and landed a face shot?
You know, I remember they asked me this during the grand jury hearing. I don't remember.
What did they tell you? How far was it?
And I really hesitate to answer because I don't remember. And what I always want to do when I tell these stories is I never want to compromise the integrity of what my thought processes were in the moment. You know, and I don't know. I really don't know exactly how far I was. I mean, I guess if I had to guesstimate, I would say maybe 15, 20 feet, 25 feet.
Are you practicing a lot with a pistol and proficient with it?
I've always been very proficient. I'm a six ward expert with a rifle and then from my Marine Corps days and a pistol. And as well, rifle expert, pistol expert. So I've always been very good at shooting. I'm not one of those people that's like a gun fanatic. I don't know everything there is to know about guns, but I like to have them. I like to keep them on me. And so to answer your question, no, I wasn't in the gun range all the time, but I do enjoy going to the gun range. And I do enjoy target practice and having, you know, people refer to it as range therapy. You know, I probably wasn't even going at that time, was not even going as much as people who enjoy range therapy per se. I would go every, you know, couple months, every few months, I would go to the range and put some stuff down. I'd take my kids. I was teaching my daughter how to shoot at that time when she was little. So things like that. But I mean, if there's anything I was practicing more than anything, it wasn't necessarily the marksmanship as much as it was the draw. I was always working on my draw. I wanted to, when the time came, and back then I wasn't thinking of when. Back then I was still of the mindset of if. And I say that a lot. It's not a matter of when, it is if, and the body will not go where the mind has never taken it. I learned that shit in my fight career. So I would always envision being in a situation where I had to draw and not being able to come out because I hadn't practiced. Mm-hmm. So if anything, that's what I practice a lot. I practice that a lot. Still, before I go out, I'll practice the draws.
It's a good idea, and I'll pass this along to a lot of people, that if you get into a routine of drawing your firearm, take it out of your holster, even that creates so many repetitions that you actually get better at. So like, instead of just taking your gun out, drawing like you would in a gun battle. I was a firearms instructor, and there'd be a lot of downtime at the range because once everybody's qualified, we still had to stay for the rest of the day. Right. And but I had unlimited bullets. Essentially, I spent most of my time practicing from 7 yards in. I figured if I made a lot of traffic stops, I was a real proactive go-getter. I said, if I'm going to get a gun battle, it's probably going to be within 7 yards, the type of work that I'm doing. Mm-hmm. I also practiced, you know, from further away. And
right.
But I would draw really fast and just put a couple shots down range and just try to get it center mass. That's what I was doing. Right. I would imagine myself being on a traffic stop in that situation. So,
right.
But yeah, the draw was the most important.
For me, especially because after that first shooting in 2012, I didn't draw as smoothly as I'd been practicing. And the reason I didn't draw as smoothly as I had practiced is because probably a week prior to this incident, I was trying to tighten my holster down on my rig. And you know, you have to use that Allen wrench to mm-hmm. screw the little screws down. Well, one of them, it popped out the bottom. It went clear on through.
Okay.
So I heard it fall out, and I'm looking for it. So now I didn't have it. So now when I'm drawing, the holster kind of cants because it's missing one of those screws, right? I knew I needed to go either get another holster or somehow get another one of those little screws. I didn't know which, but I knew I needed to do that. And I hadn't done that. I remember asking, "Hey, Sarge, you got one of these little doohickeys, one of these little thingamabobs, or, you know, to screw?" Nobody had an extra one lying around, right? Of course. So I knew I was probably going to have to go get another holster. And I hadn't done that because anybody who's ever worked night shift knows anything you need to get done, you need to take that out of your sleep time during the day. And I wasn't trying to do that. So I really dragged my ass on replacing that holster. And then I want to say the following week, maybe 10 days later, I found myself in this shooting in October of 2012. And so what I was doing in the meantime to compensate was doing these quick drills that I would do before work, but I would do them in a way that I had to twist it or pull it a certain way because it was missing that screw. So I was doing it in a way that was going to compensate, if you will, for the cant in that holster. What I was doing was I was half-assing it. And there's cops all over the country today, and you know this, and we all know this, that half-ass their training. They're half-ass preparing for what they believe could possibly happen. If it happens, I'll do this. And that was kind of my mindset, which is in stark contrast to my mindset today. Because back then I was like, if I have to draw this gun, I will do it like this instead of like this because of the cant in the holster. Well, when I went to draw, after I was thrown from this car, I went to draw, I got hemmed up. It didn't clear the holster. So it took me two tugs. Luckily, I was quick because of that practicing. And I was able to pull that firearm out and put that shot down range and it hits him, you know, right in the face. But it did cost me, you know, some serious response time. In my opinion, a split second is response time taken away from you. So I learned from that incident. There were a lot of things I learned from it. And when I found myself in a secondary gun battle in 2013, I was significantly more prepared than I was before.
Well, let's go into that. Tell me about that.
So I made a traffic stop on this car. It was a dark gray Nissan Altima. It had three guys in the car. I didn't know this at the time. There were three MS-13 gang members in the car. I don't know what kind of presence or you know, dealings you guys have with MS over there in your neck of the woods. But here it's there. It's a prominent gang over here. They have a big showing and they're active over here. So MS, if anyone's not familiar with them, they're very well known for their violence, right? Their violence, their murders, drugs, you know, you name it, they do it. Sex trafficking, all of it. And this particular night, I made contact with this car because I happened to see that it sat at a traffic light. It sat through a couple go cycles, a couple cycles of the green to red, and it didn't move. And there were a couple of other things there that were piquing my interest. All I was supposed to do that night was just stay visual, you know, stay visible, stay out there, just pass time so my partner could get back from the jail. We were going to go have some chow. But I saw this car and it had its left blinker on. And as I was driving toward it northbound, I could see from that distance that it wasn't in the left turning lane. So I'm watching this car and I'm thinking, well, it's probably going to turn left from the wrong lane. And then I'll just go ahead and make a contact real quick and just see what's going on there. Maybe they're drunk, passed out at the wheel because they sat through this light switching. Maybe they're having a medical problem, car problem, whatever it could be. It's all cycling through my mind as I'm driving past this car. I glance into it and I see that there's these two guys in the front seat. Both of them are Hispanic. I didn't see the third guy. He didn't catch my eye right out the gate. So I go ahead and make a U-turn and I initiate contact with the car, and the car, after it slow rolls for a bit, it pulls into a trailer park. And I walk up to that car. We have a very short dialogue of a bunch of, you know, bullcorn. I know what he's talking about, the driver. What he's talking about is just a bunch of lies. He's stalling all the red flags, right? The scanning, the guy's literally got his head out the window. He's scanning forward to back. He's stalling with his answers. He's repeating questions. He's speaking under his breath. Why? Because he wants to draw me to the window so that they've got a better shot at me. Because at this point I have taken position just behind the rear area of that rear passenger that sits behind the driver. That's when I saw the third guy sitting there, when I made the approach. So there's three of them in there. We're having this bullshit dialogue of just a bunch of lies. I know that they're up to no good, but I don't really know exactly what. I remember thinking maybe someone's gonna bail. Maybe someone has a warrant, someone's gonna bail, just based on the nervous actions that I was picking up, all the pre-danger cues. And I had some backup on the way. This was the pivotal moment. My position on the car, I had really good visual on my driver and my rear passenger, the guy who sat behind the driver. I felt great there. Tactically, I felt really good there. But I was giving up a lot of what I could see over here on the right-hand side from that front passenger. So there was a moment in that video where I will take a pivot out to my right. I just pivot just a bit. It gives me a little more insight into that car. And then I come on back to my original position. But there was a real pivotal moment there when the driver of that car, he actually became more still, whereas before he had his hands kind of waving around and he's looking and scanning. He was just really doing a lot of things that, in my opinion, were aimed and geared at distracting me. And he got very still and he leaned very slightly to his right. I'll never forget it. Just leaned slight. And then he turns and he mumbles something to the guy to his right, the passenger in the front seat. I remember that I could tell it was in Spanish, but I didn't hear it clearly enough to understand what he said or to know what he said. And then I know that I asked him again for this license because he was patting himself down everywhere at one point. And I remember he says, I don't have it. I don't have my license right now. And when he said that, by this time I'm frustrated and I'm annoyed because I could tell that he was plotting on me. And I felt it's probably my biggest mistake that I made in the whole thing. If I had to think of something that I wished I could change, because I get that question often, it would be that I didn't allow that to annoy me and offend me so much. Because I remember feeling that way, like, oh, okay, you're going to plot on me. Like, I'm not standing here. Like, I don't see you doing this. He must think I'm stupid. You must think I'm not, you know, paying attention. And I was annoyed. And I remember giving up a little more position at that point, asking him what he had. Well, what do you have? And so that was at the point when that front seat passenger, if you get a visual on this, you've got a driver, a front seat passenger, and then a passenger behind. So you've got this three. And the front seat passenger turns around in the seat. He kind of comes back into the back seat behind the front seat driver and in between this rear passenger. And he comes out that rear window, or at least up to the rear window. I don't even know if he cleared the window. I don't think he did, but I know he came up to that rear window, and I'm just past it initially until I leaned forward a little more. So now I turn. I don't see any of the movement that he makes when he flips around, but I see the gun. I see the muzzle of the gun, and then I see the muzzle flash. So if we're talking about how quickly this all happens, it happened so fast that I didn't even see the movement. It didn't have even time to register that this, because you have to think about, that's a lot of movement, right?
It's fast. It goes fast.
But that's a lot of movement from right. The passenger to turn around and come into the backseat. So I didn't see any of that movement. All I saw was a barrel of the gun. And then I saw muzzle flash and felt the impact of the bullet as it hits me right in the face.
Wow.
Yeah.
Where did the first bullet hit you in the face?
So the first shot hits me in my left cheekbone here, right in here. It travels through my face and comes out the left part of my jawline. So wow. Right just under here. It comes out just under my ear and takes my earlobe and just destroys that as well. So that's hanging by a thread. So I have two holes in my face from a through and through injury from the bullet. And then as I turned and started to do this tactical retreat, right? The second shot hits just here, right here, just to the left side of my breast, my left breast. Of course, I'm wearing a vest, but it hits me at the softest point of the vest and goes right on into my chest cavity.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. Or my titty, one of the two, whichever.
Did it create a sucking chest wound?
I didn't get a sucking chest wound, but I got a titty chest wound. Mm. It was the bullet in my chest that went in. And what's interesting is the round of this bullet, the round was lodged in the vest. So they ended up finding inside of the vest the round, but not before it went inside of my body, and then kind of it pops back out with the wow. vest still holding it. So I think of things from the perspective of boxing and fighting and how, because there's just so much to learn from the strategy of the art of war, if you will, right? So when you hit a heavy bag, you hit it, right? Bam. And the bag goes, and then it comes on back. We call this what?
Inertia?
Right. That's the word, inertia. It goes and it comes on back, right? What goes up must come down, that type of thing. So I imagine that same concept with this bullet. It hits probably that softest point of the vest. It hits maybe that even that first panel, but then it bounces, you know, it goes in and bounces, and there's no more vest here because it's done, right? Mm-hmm. This vest was custom made for my body, so it fit well, but there's no more vest there. Again, our vest different from your vest. The amount of coverage in that area is going to be different. And so it goes in, but then it comes right back just like a heavy bag would, and the vest holds it. So it was found in the vest. It didn't stay in my body. Sucking chest wound, no. But I know that there's a big hole there that the trauma doctor was digging around in for a while, trying to find an exit wound, trying to find a spent, you know, that trying to find the bullet if it was in my body, in my chest, but ultimately it was in the vest. So good.
Who discovered it in the vest? Who discovered it in the vest?
My chief discovered it in the vest. That's really interesting detail that no one really ever asks me. When I was in the trauma room, the doctor was digging his fingers in this hole.
Jesus Christ.
Yes. 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 And I don't like saying that. Like I was raised, you know, you don't say Jesus or Jesus Christ. When I say Jesus Christ, the way you just say Jesus Christ, I am hissed. That is like a, right. So I don't like, you know, saying, oh, Jesus Christ, just to use the word, we call that taking the Lord's. And my mom, you better not take the Lord's name in vain. So when my daughter says that today, Jesus Christ, I'm like, you better be praying. Are you over there saying a prayer? Because I just heard you say Jesus Christ. But in that moment, in the trauma room where the doctor's got his big old sausage fingers in my chest like that, I was screaming all kinds of Jesus Christ. It was incredibly painful. And he couldn't find the round and he was screaming for the vest and we couldn't find the vest. And so my chief ends up beat feeding it to the police department. I didn't even notice he'd left the trauma room and found it there in the vest. Somebody had taken the vest from the scene. So it was at the PD. And that's odd because in the Marine Corps, if you get shot, your vest goes with you everywhere you go. You don't get separated from your vest. But I guess it's not like that in civilian world. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Interesting, so, to say the least. Yeah.
These guys, obviously, take the shot in the face, take a shot in the side. What happens right after that? Were you able to get on the radio? Were you able to retreat, get cover, return fire? Tell me about that part.
So we have this gun battle because once I'm hit, and that second shot knocks me back, I'm stumbling back because the power behind that bullet, I felt the second shot significantly more painful and powerful than the first one. And so it knocks me back and I go into what I refer to in my presentations as conversations with yourself. And it's that, you know, that 5 minutes feeling of 5-10 minutes of conversation a split second. So I was going through all of that, you know, the time distortion, the whole, you know, the oh shit moment thoughts that you're having. I'm counting my steps, 1, 2, 3, as I'm stumbling back, I'm counting my steps and I'm trying to keep myself from falling down. I didn't want to hit the ground behind this car and just be there as a sitting duck waiting for them to either run me over or keep shooting me. Right. So it felt like a long conversation of don't go down, counting my steps, being cognizant of my steps, and all kinds of things, the pain. I know that my vest didn't catch that. Oh, just all kinds of oh shit moment thoughts until I finally said to myself, because it felt like a long time. It just felt like a long time of me being in my own head. And then I remember saying, you're in a gun battle here, girl. Any day you want to start shooting. And it snapped me out of it. So I whip around on 3. I'll never forget. I was on 3 on my right foot. And I whip back around and I start return fire. And with every shot that I'm firing, I can feel the pain all down the left side of my chest and arm and leg. I mean, just everything hurt. And I remember seeing clearly as they're speeding off, because that's what cowards do, right? And they're speeding off. I see one of my bullets hit just to the right of the keyhole on the trunk. And I remember thinking, ah, my group is dropping. And as they sped off and I saw that shot, because the first shot that I fired, it shatters that rear window. So now it's open. But when I did happen to see the bullet hit and make that mark just to the right, I remember thinking, stop. Just don't waste your ammo, right? Just let them go on out of here, see what their next move is. And that's what I did. And they left the property. I self-assessed immediately, habit. That's Marine Corps training for me and my fight career to self-assess, to constantly be cognizant of where my body is in this battle, pain-wise. And that's what I did. I started doing this with my fingers immediately, just doing this back and forth with my fingers and taking my tongue and running it across my teeth, checking for my teeth to make sure they weren't lodged in my airway. I knew they were intact. My jaw was intact. I knew I could breathe. I could talk. I still had my fine motor skills about me. My heart was still ticking. And well, I mean, we keep working. So that's what I did. I knew they drove out of the property and fled. And there was just a fire in me that just no way, hell no. You're not about to just start this whole situation and then drive off like you didn't just do this. I was still in the fight. I knew I was still in the fight and we don't finish until we finish. So I hopped in that car and I initiated pursuit.
What point did you get on the radio and let them know you'd been hit? Was it quick?
Immediately. Yeah. Immediately after we were done exchanging. So
on your portable or the radio in the car?
On my portable. So I shoot, and as right as I'm done shooting, I'm putting it out. Shots fired. I'm hit.
They acknowledged it. There was radio. The air was open. They acknowledged it.
They did. Yep.
And then you're in pursuit. Now what happens?
We end up in Houston, Harris County. The cavalry is in Houston's coming, and the cavalry in Fort Bend County is coming. And but ultimately, I ended up in pursuit for a good bit.
Were you giving a lot of information about your injuries? And
oh, yes. The radio traffic. And you know what's interesting is that seems to be, I don't know if you've ever watched the dash cam video of this, but that seems to be what really floors a lot of people, civilians and law enforcement alike, is that I was so calm and that I was still giving so much information. I was calling directionals and turns and before we even got onto those streets. So I was very, very cognizant of what was happening. I was very aware. Tunnel vision is not our friend. And so it's something that when I'm training and I'm preparing myself mentally, I'm very aware of that. In the fight game, you can't have tunnel vision or you're going to get yourself knocked out. So I believe a lot of the philosophies, the disciplines, the tactics that I learned in my fight career served me that night, because I really was drawing upon that stuff. Paying attention to directions, calling out my directions, talking to dispatch, letting them know, hey, dispatch, I've been shot twice. I know I've been hit in the face. I did say, and the vest. I said the vest, knowing that I had been, my vest had been compromised in some way, and I had been shot, and the bullet did enter my body. But I also knew that I was still very much in control. I did not feel at all any effects that I was going to pass out. I'm familiar with how that feels. So I trust myself. I listen to my body. My partners trust me. My supervisor, my sergeant at the time, knows me, and, you know, they knew I had it. And so they let me work. And I pursued on into the next city. We pursued for, it was probably about 9 minutes or so.
It's a long time.
It felt like a long, long time. And when we got to the area in the neighborhood that they end up pulling off this highway, this toll road, and turning back into this area in Houston, that's pretty dangerous from what I hear. You know, I'm relying on street signs, right? I'm relying on street signs. I'm going into a city that I don't know, I don't patrol, and I'm still by myself, because even though the cavalry is coming, they have not caught up to us yet. So I'm injured, I'm compromised, I'm alone in a city that I don't know, in a location that I can't readily give. So at this point, I knew it was time to go ahead and drop back. Mind you, they're still shooting at me throughout
this pursuit. Holy shit. Wow.
So I'm taking fire. As we're in pursuit, they're still shooting at me out of there. They have this clear area too, because I've blown this rear window out. So I take all of this stuff into consideration, and I go ahead and draw back. Once they pull into this area, and it was also the way they pulled into this area. You're talking about traveling over 100 miles per hour at some points of this pursuit, to now they're going super slow and they use their turn signal before they go into this neighborhood. I was like, oh, you must think I'm stupid. That was, to me, it spoke volumes, this turn signal that he used. And it said to me, hey, come on, come here, come follow me, right? And so I felt like, oh, okay, you're baiting me. You're trying to bait me into an ambush situation, and I'm not having it. So I dropped back, and they went on into this neighborhood. I lost sight of them, and I just held my ground there. Sergeant said the same thing, hey, stand your ground. And it was just really beautiful in that we were all on the same page at that time. He wasn't in the car with me, but based on my radio traffic and how that command presence changes, I had all this command. Hey, they're going left on Blue Bonnet. Well, before I'm even on Blue Bonnet, right to, we're making a right on Grand Fork, you know, because he can tell now I'm reading signs. And it just, what I really loved about that is the fact that you have this synergy with your team. You should. And they might not have been right there with me, but he too knew that it was time that I draw back. We were all on the same page, even though we weren't even in the same area, in the same city. So that was really a really cool thing to see, to feel that we still had that rhythm going that you get when you work with a team for so many years. So they finally arrive, and my thought process was that we would set up a perimeter and let Houston get there and kind of help take over this area. And I just needed to turn it over. I wanted to turn it over to them. because I knew I had to assess my wounds. And so that was naturally the next step. As everybody started to arrive, they took over and then we focused on me.
Did you get into an ambulance? You just drive right to the hospital?
No, Houston, we have so many Houston people there that they literally just, you know, put me on the gurney and loaded me up in the box. And Houston escorted us from that area to the trauma center. I know is not close, but I remember we were there fast. We were there so fast. It wasn't until they loaded me in that ambulance that I started to really worry about my injuries.
Mm-hmm. You have kids, right? Two kids. Two
right. I had two kids at home at the time. My son was 18. My daughter was 9.
Jesus Christ. And sorry, I did it again. Sorry, Grandma. Okay.
Are you praying? Are you praying? You better be praying.
I'm praying but for you. In the
so,
past.
I started thinking about that stuff when I got in the ambulance, but then no sooner I started to think about it and entertain it and feel the pain of it, knowing that, fuck, you know, this is the second time and, you know, what kind of mom are you? What a shitty person to put your kids through this again. And they had just gone through this trauma a year before. And it really, I started to get in my own head. And so as quickly as I went there, I knocked myself right on out by doing what we normally do, which is what? Make jokes. Mm-hmm. So I started making jokes and I was laughing and joking the whole way there, with the exception of that first few minutes that they put me in there. And I started to realize, like, wow, you know, maybe you're hurt more than you think you are. And you're not going to make it home, you know? So those thoughts started to enter and the guilt and all of that comes with it. And I said, no, we're not going to do that. So I started making jokes.
You ever tell yourself at some point, like, I'm surviving this no matter what, like you're in the ambulance now. I'm talking, we're kind of like, I'm not going anywhere. I'm surviving this fucking thing.
I don't think I'd even once entertained dying. I am honest from my lips to God's ears. I didn't think about dying until I got in the ambulance for that brief minute. Like, oh, you know, cause I'm looking at the faces of the people in the ambulance that are working on me and they look real serious. And that's what made me think about it. Oh, damn. You know, but then, so there was not a time that I go, nope, I'm not dying today. No, I didn't have to shift. I just know that as soon as I felt it sort of creep in, I didn't let myself go there.
Mm-hmm. Did you make decisions about that before going into this? How you would be?
Yeah. 1,000,000% yes. In that year.
What are some things you told yourself prior to this that helped you be prepared for it? Like the mental part of it.
You really want to know?
Yeah.
I got to be the hardest motherfucker to kill. You're a Marine. You're a U.S. Marine and Marines are hard to kill. There's a reason why the Germans, they gave us the nickname Teufelhunden, which means devil dog. Because we're vicious. We're vicious. We're known for that vicious, relentless attack on the threat. And I've kind of always, and I say maybe it's because I was raised by a jarhead. I don't know. Jarhead is another nickname for Marine.
Yeah, I'm familiar.
I don't know, but I've always, you know, everybody has a fight response, right? A fear response, a threat response, fight or flight, and freeze even. And some people will freeze and some people will flee. And then some people will fight. And you know, law enforcement officers are a very rare breed. We're a very unique breed of people that are willing to engage the dangers that we see. I know that I've always kind of been a little scrappy, if you will, fight. That was my fear response always. But yes, I absolutely had to program my mind for these moments. I think the majority of time that I ever did that, though, was in that year in between. So that's a testament to how effective and powerful it can be from one shooting to the next. I don't know that the response would have been as it was if I had not prepared in that year from one shooting to the next. I don't know that it would be exactly the same way. Naturally, I would have probably still engaged and still tried, you know, but there's a lot of mental clarity that I had that night that I don't think I may not have had it as clear, but since I prepared, I knew, like, I know this is going to happen again. I know that I have to be ready because you can't get ready in the moment. You're supposed to be ready, right? That's just the rules. And I know I learned that in the fight game, in my fight career. Let me step in the ring and not be prepared. That's what I love about the fight game. It's so honest, right? Football, basketball, all these other team sports. If you want to lax and be lazy and not put 100% into training, your team could kind of pick up the slack for you, but it's not like that in the fight game. You go in there by yourself, you're exposed. Everyone's watching and you go mano a mano. And the guy or girl in that ring is that prepared the heart the most. That one's going to come through. You're going to see it. And if you didn't prepare and you're not ready, everyone will see. And so I just feel like that was my mindset moving into the second shooting. Like, I do not ever want to feel ill-prepared. I do not ever want to feel like my response time was compromised. I don't want to, you know, stick my arm in car windows and, you know, make dumb mistakes like that. So you got to be focused. And I was, and I attribute that to a lot of why I was able to handle the situation the way that I did, but I will not let anyone hear this story and not say this. And that is, yes, mental preparedness is important for us to be ready. But for me and the way that I believe what happened to me that night and why I survived it, for me is one reason. And that reason is because God upstairs said, "Anne, it's not time. I need you to stay there. It's not your time to go. I've got something for you to do." And because of his grace and mercy to give me my life, my continued life, he knew he was going to put me on the path to the fight after the fight. I had no clue. Because after the shooting, I thought, well, I'm good. I'm done. I made it home. I made it home twice. That had always been my ultimate goal. But, you know, there's a huge problem with we all go home. It's not enough to make it home. And that's the problem with we all go home. Do we want to go home? Yes. Is it enough? No, but I know that. So that was my ultimate goal at the time. And I just thank God for giving me life, for keeping me alive. You know, even this many years later, it is not lost on me how blessed I am to be here, to watch my children continue to grow and to meet men and women across the country who've been through this, that have survived it. And then like me, didn't have the tools in the aftermath for the emotional survival aspect of it. Because, oh my God, who told me? Nobody told me. Who told you? Anybody ever sit you down and teach you about that part? No. And so I think that's another reason why God spared me. Because he knew that I was going to have to go through another battle, another fight, if you will. And that I was going to have to teach other people how to get through that one too. So it was always going to be for that. I just didn't know it at the time.
So you're in the ambulance, you pull up to the hospital.
Yep.
Staff's ready for you, I'd imagine.
Oh yeah. You know what was the most impressive? Yeah, the staff was ready for me. Boy, they were like, I want to say right out there waiting. Literally is how I feel like I remember it. I don't know. I know that there was officers. It felt like there were already officers there. But you know what was the most impressive thing is that my rep, my TMPA rep was there before I was. I thought that was really impressive because, you know, these aren't things that you ever really think about being a big deal when you're whoever you sign up for your legal teams. And, you know, here in Texas, we have TMPA and we have CLEAT and all that other stuff. But when you sign up because you think, well, and just if this happens, I'll have this representation, right? That somebody's sole focus is me. But I got to tell you, man, when I got to that hospital and that guy was right there and he's like, "Hey, I'm here," right? They were wheeling me in. And I remember, I feel like he was looking down and he was telling me, following the gurney and saying, "Hey, I'm here. I'm from TMP. I'm here for you. I'm here." And I was like, man, it was just a great feeling. I don't know why, but that really stood out to me in that moment. Like, my family wasn't there yet, but my rep was there. And boy, did that make me feel good, you know?
No, your family was there. Your family was there the whole time with you. You know, yeah. You're different. You maybe not your blood family, but your blue blood family was there.
Oh, my blue blood. Let me tell you, my blue family, there was a lot of them there. And that's always great, you know, to have the people that, you know, you work alongside show up for you right then and there was really great. But I'll tell you what, those are also the people who you don't see. They show up. And then they go because they go back onto their lives and into, you know, work. And then you're just like crickets going, wow, I feel kind of lonely. But And I don't think that they do it necessarily from a position of malice or, you know, not trying to be mean, but they got lives. And I think, you know, 6 months, a year and a half after your shooting, no one's really thinking about that anymore. But that's when it starts to, you know, really come for you.
I think it's
you're
good
taking the shots. You're taking these shots and you're thinking to myself, man, this, that sucked. Oh, and then the surgeries that came after those injuries, all that sucks so bad. And it's so painful, but, and it's hard. It's so hard because you've got, you know, the physical trauma and pain and then the surgeries and then the stress of all of that and the stress on your family. And then workers' comp is stress. And, you know, it's just all just stress, 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 stress. You're like, this is so hard. And then you heal up and you get well and you get back to work and you're excited because you think the worst has passed me. And you have no idea. Like, oh no, baby girl, that was the easy part. You know what I mean? Like, wow, that was the easy part. But it's true. That was the easy part.
The mental games began, huh?
Oh my gosh. Yes. That's what I refer to as the fight after the fight. They teach you to win the fight on the streets because we all go home is our ultimate goal. And that's what I mean by that's not enough. It does us no good to make it home if we don't know what the hell to do once we get there with what we see that we can't unsee. What kind of sense does that make? None. So I had to figure it out on my own with the help of some really key players. And I had to go to battle again.
You know, in some weird way as you talk, I guess you were the chosen one to start changing things. You had to go through the shit to understand what it is and how to start fixing it.
Well, I don't think you could appreciate, I don't think I would have been able to appreciate this gift that God gave me if it was just that easy. I think you got to work, you know, you got to work at things that you truly intend on enjoying. I know I look at couples that have been married for like 60 years and 70 years, these old couples, and they're, and my heart opens and I'm like, wow, you know, what is the, how do you do that? Like, what is the secret? You know, cause I'm divorced. So I'm like, just tell me, maybe I'll get it right another time. I don't know, but just tell me what the secret is. Right. And it never fails. They all have different answers, but the one thing they have in common is you got to work at it. You know, anything worth having is worth working for. And I think that if it would have been easy, if I would have been shot and survived and then got back to work fairly unscathed physically or even emotionally, I don't think that I would have appreciated this gift, this second, well, third chance at life that God gave me. I wouldn't have. I'm pretty sure of it. But I had to go to that place to get to this place, to become this version of myself. And for that reason, it was all well worth it. Yeah.
Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at streetcop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out streetcop.com for that offer.